resources, let's say, for anxiety, such as clarity about how big the threats actually are, so we don't overestimate them or underestimate them, and clarity about the kind of resources we have for dealing with them. All right, that's the first major benefit of routinely taking in the good, growing resources in particular. Second, built into this process are implicit benefits. For example, it's a mindfulness training. In meditative language, it's a kind of mini concentration practice in which we sustain attention to something useful to draw it into ourselves. It's really quite powerful to appreciate the quotation from the godfather of psychology in America, William James, who said, "The education of attention would be the education par excellence. Where we rest our attention and what we do with what our attention rests upon is the front end of who we are becoming." Now, there's an old saying, you are what you eat. Actually, more fundamentally, you are what you pay attention to and what you do with what you pay attention to. So implicitly in taking in the good, in addition to a mindfulness training, is a sense of being on your own side, of being for yourself. You're trying to help yourself. You're treating yourself like you matter, which is especially important if you haven't felt like you've mattered enough to other people. A third kind of benefit from repeatedly and deliberately internalizing beneficial experiences, which is my core definition of taking in the good, deliberately internalizing beneficial experiences, the third benefit of that, plausibly, is that you could be sensitizing your brain to the positive. In effect, if the brain has a negativity bias, we can gradually potentially train it into more of a positivity bias. We'll still see the red lights. We'll still see that strange expression on the face of that other person we've got to deal with. But we'll be more resourced inside for dealing with it. And we'll actually be more effective with those other people when we shift out of the negativity bias, because less and less and less of the negative experiences of life will be sticking to us like Velcro. And instead, we'll be more able to see real threats, real issues, rather than being distracted by little ones and little preoccupations, and we'll have more resources for dealing with these challenges. So that's the third kind of benefit, the actual sensitization of the brain to the positive. So it becomes quicker and more efficient and better at turning passing beneficial states into lasting beneficial traits. And then the fourth benefit of doing this is that as we grow resources inside ourselves, we become more effective and capable in the world and with other people. Not always, but it's a good odd strategy. The world starts treating us better, doors start opening, we start seeing opportunities, and positive cycles with others can develop as well. As I finish here, I'd like to step back and really summarize where we've been. I think that it's so important in life to grow strengths inside, to grow resources of various kinds. It's easy to dismiss this process as some kind of la-di-da luxury item. No, this is the essence of self-reliance, including the self-reliance we need to draw upon and develop inside for the challenges all around us. We need to develop these strengths. Well, how do we develop these strengths? One of the great strengths is learning, knowing how to learn. And it's the strength that grows the other strengths. As a kid, I read a lot of comic books. I think about superpowers. Learning is the superpower of superpowers because it's the one we draw upon to grow the rest of them. So learning how to learn the things that are important to you could be the greatest strength of all. I hope this program has been useful to you. This is the fundamental how of self-help. This is the fundamental how of moving through your day in ways that no one can defeat, to grow the good bit by bit, synapse by synapse, drop by drop inside you. No one can stop you from doing this in the experiences that you're having over the course of your day, in the inner sanctuary of your own mind. No one can stop you from learning and growing, healing and developing bit by bit, step by step. And no one can do it for you. This is what makes it authentic and real and legitimate, and as we've explored, even in the context of the baby science that is neuroscience, everything we've explored here is completely plausible based on research evidence. So to finish here, I'd like to offer a quotation that has been personally very meaningful to me, and I think really summarizes everything we've explored here. And it comes to us from the Dhammapada, text written over 2,000 years ago. Here's the quotation. "Think not lightly of good, saying, 'It will not come to me.' Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good." As you fill yourself with good, drop by drop, bit by bit, synapse by synapse, hour by hour, and day by day, that you can grow more of the good inside yourself for your own sake and in ways that can ripple out and help other people. Thank you very much.
Coming up, Christine Carlson shares powerful stories of grief and transformation that illustrate how mindfulness can help you overcome heartache and loss.
And people have asked me many times, can we prepare for loss? And the answer is yes, we can prepare for loss. We prepare for loss in how we live. It's how we practice life that prepares us.
Lecture 5, Mindfulness in Heartbreak.
Christine Carlson is a passionate messenger for joyful and peaceful living, mindfulness, and self-rediscovery. Her mission expands on the phenomenal success of her late husband, Dr. Richard Carlson's work on the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series. Christine is one of the most generous, compassionate, and wise women I know, and it is an honor to have her join this course, Masters of Mindfulness.
Hello, I'm Christine Carlson. It is my honor to be a teacher in this series as I share this hour with you. But first, let's take a pause together, something I call a golden pause. It'll just get you listening in your heart and get you grounded and centered for this hour. So let's begin by sitting comfortably with our legs uncrossed if you're sitting in a chair. And if you're sitting Indian style on the floor, just lean back against something and keep your shoulders back and arms on your lap and palms open, and let's just begin to breathe together. So go ahead and close your eyes and breathe with me. As you breathe in through your nose, allowing your chest and your belly to fully expand, taking in the fullness of your breath. And as you exhale, just go ahead and relax and sink into your body, sink into your breath. This time as you breathe in golden sunlight, pure golden sunlight to the top of your head, to the tips of your fingers and toes, to every cell of your being, pure golden sunlight. And as you exhale, just go ahead and relax and sink a little bit deeper. And this time as you breathe in golden sunlight, pure golden sunlight, place your hand on your heart, activating your heart, opening your heart, and just spend a moment with me thinking of one thing you feel incredibly grateful for. It could be a person, a place, a thing, something somebody recently said to you. And just breathe in that gratitude. And as you breathe in that gratitude, taking it in, soaking it in, filling your whole being with gratitude, go ahead and exhale and open your eyes. That golden pause is just an amazing thing to put into practice no matter what you're doing throughout your busy day. Doesn't matter where you are, you can always take a pause, and it just helps you become more responsive, more grounded in your body, and much more responsive to life. So there are so many reasons and so many different ways that we face hardship and heartbreak and loss. And people have asked me many times, can we prepare for loss? And the answer is yes, we can prepare for loss. We prepare for loss in how we live. It's how we practice life that prepares us. And understanding and practicing mindfulness will not only help you in your everyday life, but will help you immensely as you heal from heartbreak of all kinds. There are five principles of mental health and well-being I'd like to share with you today. These principles are the foundation of the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book series, a series that has impacted millions of people around the globe. These principles of awareness teach us how to practice accessing our mental health and well-being in all situations, and including heartbreak and loss. There's no doubt that we are going to endure both physical and emotional pain in life. But here's how suffering becomes optional. It's in your mental reactions and your emotions and your ability to return to a gentle and loving awareness of them that will help you recover from loss in a healthy way. As you understand these principles, you'll free yourself from the mental dynamics that can keep you stuck and suffering. Five principles of awareness are thoughts, moods, feelings, your agreement with reality, and present moment living. So I'm going to share with you a little bit about each one of these principles, and throughout this session today, I'll be referring to them. So here's what I have to say about thought. You know, I want you to think of thinking, your thinking, as being as automatic to you as your breathing. You just don't think about every breath until you sit down to meditate, right? Well, thinking is the same way. Thinking is very automatic to us. And we have so many thousands of thoughts, 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day. And how many of those thoughts are we really aware of? Not very many of them. But one really interesting thing about thought is that so many of those thoughts are repetitive as well. But there's two things. That's the first that I'd love you to understand about thought, is that it's automatic to you. And that the other thing is that you are the thinker. Just repeat that to yourself for a moment. You are the thinker. You're literally just making up these thoughts in your own head all day long. It's coming from you. It's not coming from something outside of you. You are your own thinker. Just understanding those two things about thought are profound. But the other thing I want you to be aware of about thought is that we have repetitive thinking, repetitive thought patterns that we get into. In our work, in the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book series, and in my late husband, Dr. Richard Carlson's work, he called them thought attacks. When you get on this circular thinking and you just can't stop it. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know that thing that bugged you that happened yesterday, but today you're still thinking about it and you can't get off of it. Or it's that conversation that you're repeating over and over and over in your head as if you need some sort of dress rehearsal. Yeah, I know you're looking at me going, uh-huh, I get it. So you are the thinker and thinking is automatic to you. The second principle of moods is that we all have them, don't we? You have moods? I'm sure you're saying, yes, you have moods. Doesn't your toddler have moods? Don't you know even your dog has moods? We all go up and down with our moods, and our moods move up and down like the weather. And we have high moods and we have low moods. So let me just ask you this. If you've ever been in a relationship or in a current relationship, when do most people in relationship talk about their problems? Do they talk about their problems in a high mood, or do they talk about their problems in a low mood? Yeah, I know you're laughing at that, right? Yep, most couples will talk about their problems in a low mood. But what would happen if you waited to talk about your problems until your mood got higher? In a low mood, everything could be annoying. Even your dog wagging his tail because he wants something from you can be annoying. You know, the same thing that your spouse or partner says to you when you're in a high mood might really bother you in a low mood. And ladies, if you're watching, if you've got PMS, you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about low moods. Life just looks different in a low mood than it does in a high mood. And that's the same for all of us. So doesn't it behoove us as a culture to think about, in all of our relationships, when we're in conflict with somebody, to ask the question, what kind of mood is this person in? Should I, or what kind of mood am I in? Should I really be talking to this person now when I'm in a low mood or when they're in a low mood? I used to ask my husband before I asked him for something that I really wanted. I used to ask him, and he knew exactly where I was going with this, because of course we learned these principles together a long time ago. I used to say, "Hey, honey, are you in a high mood or a low mood?" And he would say, "Yeah, why are you asking?" But the reason why I would ask is because knowing that life looks different in a higher mood, I'm much more likely to receive, what I'm looking for if I ask it a high mood, right? It's just smart. But it's also smart in all of your relationships to think of that concept of moods. Is somebody in a high mood or a low mood? And the ideal is when you can become graceful when low and grateful when high. So I'm going to talk about feelings as a principle of awareness. Feelings can become a guidepost and a barometer of your thinking. We all have feelings, but a lot of times we can't have feelings before we think a thought first. I'm not saying it's impossible to have a feeling without a thought, but I'm just saying that most of the time you can ask yourself if you're feeling low, you can ask yourself to look to your thinking and ask yourself, what am I thinking right now? And in this way, feelings become an amazing barometer to helping you understand and become more aware of all of those thoughts that we talked about earlier, which become invisible to you. So now we'll talk about what is your agreement with reality. First of all, I want to talk about separate realities and the fact that we all view the world through our own lens, our own unique filter. And this filter is made up from our belief system, from our childhoods, from actually every experience that we have. This affects the filter by which we view the world. Now, every person has their own filter, very unique to them. They see the world through their own unique lens. But along with this is, what kind of agreement with reality do we have? And what I mean by that is, many people, I'm going to talk throughout this session about what it means to choose to be the victim or the victor over your circumstances, or the victim or the hero. And when I do, I'm talking about what kind of agreement with reality do you have? Sometimes, unknowingly, we have an agreement with reality that we're living at the affect of our circumstances. And that means that in a way we have a victim mentality. What I'm going to hope to do is show you that you can choose and change your agreement with reality at any time. And at any time, you can choose to be the victor over your circumstances or the hero of your own story. And that's all I'm going to say about agreement with reality for right now, because there's more to come. The last principle, which is probably the most profoundly important principle, is present moment living. It's the highest level of awareness and engagement that you can have in your life, is present moment living. Now, it's really funny to think of it this way, but when do you think people are most engaged in their lives? I'll tell you, research shows that people are most engaged in their lives while they're having sex. That's right. Because they're not likely to look down at their cell phone, and they're not likely to, be concerned about anything else in that moment. Now, if they are, well, maybe you got some problems there. But the truth is, people are super highly engaged. People are also really highly engaged in a dangerous situation too. You know, when you're hiking and you have to scale rocks or you have to watch your footing, you know, these are times when you might notice life really slowing down. And life does slow down when you're super present. But also, where I'm going to talk about present moment living in this session is that present moment living is the safest place to land as you're going through any kind of heartbreak or loss. It's because as we think about our past and we're thinking in our regrets about what we'd like to change about what happened to us, about any kind of situation, we're not living presently. And when we're thinking in our future, generally we could be super afraid. We could be having a lot of fear. And that's not being present moment oriented either. But when you land in the center, right in the center, in the moment, it truly is the safest place because you don't have anything filling you up but this present moment and the awareness of what is right now. So I'm going to share my personal story with you now. Just start back in college when I met my late husband, Richard Carlson. We were very young and we had kind of a fairy tale romance, to be sure. It was one of those meet, fall in love, and almost at first meeting. I won't say first sight, but first meeting. Anyways, fast forward, we got married a few years later, and we co-authored our first daughter about 4 years into our marriage, Jasmine, and then a couple of years later we had Kenna. And our lives were really humming along. We were very much on a spiritual path together. Richard was getting his master's and his PhD in psychology. I was running a business. We were practicing meditation every day. We had this, we just were building our lives. So I like to say that Don't Sweat the Small Stuff was an overnight success story because it took 10 years and it took 10 books. And after Richard's 10th book, he had been saying the same things in his work and his early work. You can be happy no matter what. You can feel good again. Stop thinking, start living. All of those books. And yet Don't Sweat the Small Stuff resonated with millions of people around the globe. We had no idea that was going to happen. Of course, we hoped it would, but we had no idea that that would happen. So speed forward again on the 10th anniversary of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And by this time, there were about 7 or 8 books in the series at this point. Richard had invited me to write with him in the series in Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love. And also, I had written my first solo book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Women. At the 10th anniversary, Richard was departing his Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series and working on other works. And he was on a book tour, going on a book tour. And one ordinary day, just like any other, he was headed out to New York on a flight. And on that day, I woke up, you know, did my breakfast dishes, you know, got my kids off to school. And this was back in 2006. And I got a phone call. And I looked down at my phone. And it was the New York area code. And Richard always called me when he landed safely. So I assumed it was that he was calling me. And I opened up the phone call, you know, started talking on the phone, and there was a nurse and a doctor on the phone, and they were firing questions at me, very urgently firing questions at me. And it became concerning to me, you know, why they were asking me so many questions. And then they told me that something had happened on Richard's flight into New York. And I said, "What do you mean something happened?" And they said, "We're sorry to inform you, Mrs. Carlson, Mr. Carlson has expired." And you can imagine how that word didn't land with me very well. How I became very, I couldn't comprehend what that word meant. Couldn't comprehend what these people were telling me. I'm not sure I would have been able to comprehend it anyways. But in a few minutes later, I realized that the love of my life had died from a pulmonary embolism on that flight. And it was really sudden. And in one phone call, it completely shattered my life and the life of my daughters, Richard's parents, his sisters, my parents, and everyone who knew him. We were completely heartbroken at this news. Now just take a deep breath with me. I know that's a hard story to sit and hear, and it touches everyone because we all know that life can change on a dime. And sometimes it does, and it did for me. I call this the initiation by crisis event. And the reason why I call it that is I follow along in Joseph Campbell's work a little bit here, where he talks about on the hero's journey the initiation, and that a crisis event shatters our world, causing us to head on a new trajectory of life. We can always tell when we're having an initiation by crisis event because it represents a loss of identity. Now, this loss of identity can come so many different ways to all of us and different ways and different times in our lives. It could be the loss of a loved one through death or divorce, as I experienced. It could be the loss of your health. You know, one day you're humming along, you're thinking you're this healthy person, you go to the doctor and find out otherwise. You could lose your home, you could have a 40-year career, and it's suddenly over. You can have all sorts of different losses that represent this loss of identity. But I'm going to share with you that there's just really two ways that this can land for you. In this heartbreak and this loss, you can either be heartbroken open, or you can become shut down and bitter. But if you become heartbroken open, as I did in your loss, you'll wake up to feeling more alive. You know, just before Richard died, I remember hiking on our hill, and I remember feeling very passionless in my life at that point. In fact, I had a conversation with a friend too, and he asked me, "Chris, what are you feeling really passionate about?" And I remember saying to him, "I don't know. I don't feel very much passion right now. Why do I need passion?" And I think that's really funny now, but that's really how I felt at the time. And just right before Richard died, it was like I got that news and a pressurized water hose hit me square in the face, and it woke me up. Really, really woke me up. Woke me up to feeling life, feeling all of it. But it also woke me up to a mantra, a way to heal that I hadn't thought of in a lot of years. And, you know, when you go through such a sudden loss, and I didn't have a lot of experience with grief. My parents were alive. Richard's parents were alive. I didn't really know how I was going to go through this loss. But I did know that I had to surrender to what was coming. I did know, based on all my years in the personal growth world and in my own personal study, that this was not something I was going to be able to fight or resist. This was something I was going to have to open to, and I was going to have to feel my feelings to heal. I was going to have to go through a process of healing, a process of grieving. So this mantra I now call the Star Mantra, because it goes, I surrender, I trust, I accept, I release, I receive. I'm going to talk more about this mantra throughout this session, so I'm not going to talk as much about it right here, but what I want you to really understand about surrender is this. Surrender doesn't mean giving up. It doesn't mean giving in. Surrender means allowing. Surrender means allowing yourself to be broken open, allowing yourself to open to what is, allowing yourself to be present for what is. Now, there's only one question that any of us need to ask in order to know if surrender is what we need, and that is, can I change this? Can I change this? So as I said, I didn't really know that much about grieving. But I'll tell you what, when that first wave of grief hit me, I knew what it was. I remember I was walking up our driveway, and I was headed up to our water softener. I had to get a 50-pound bag of salt out of our car, and I had to carry it to the water softener and put it in. It was 3 weeks after Richard had died, and my kids were getting ready for school. And I pulled this bag of salt out of my car, and I remember thinking, wow, I have to do this now too. You know how guys always carry out the garbage? Well, Richard carried out the garbage and he carried the salt up to the water softener. So that really hit me hard that I was doing something that he'd be doing that day. And it really hit me hard. I had a big wave of grief come over me. It knocked me to my knees, clear to my knees. Knocked the wind out of me. It was so big. But what that really taught me was that I knew in that moment I was giving birth to something. I knew because the only pain I'd ever felt that severe was when I was birthing my children. And it felt like the same kind of contractions. And I thought, by God, I feel like I'm in labor. Wow. I had no idea that I was going to be birthing a new life. But here's the other thing I learned through grief, and that these waves would come and go, but if I did resist, I would feel it in my body. And my body began to inform me when I needed to grieve more deeply. My body began to talk to me. And I became very aware that I had this healer inside. Now, how did I learn this? Well, in my process of surrender, I would lay down on the floor and I would lay down in a spread eagle position. And I knew that my stomach would hurt when I wasn't crying enough. And I knew that if I just allowed my body to shake and I allowed myself to feel whatever was present, that would come. My tears would come. My screams would come. Whatever I would need would come. And I would just express. You know, that's what I always tell people, you know, just express out what's there. And then when you do, your body then rewards you with feeling good. So just, I want to touch a little bit on this time of grieving and how you can almost prepare for your journey of grief in a way. What you need is always really crystal clear in these situations if you take the time to reflect on that. I know that when I was in labor, I was really crystal clear about what I needed then too. And most women will tell you that they are. They know exactly what they need and when they need it. Well, this time period is also like that. It's okay for you to completely design this time period how you need it, not how anybody else wants you to have it. So the first thing I would say is the world's going to tell you to stay really busy when you're going through grief and going through loss. But I'm going to tell you the opposite. I'm going to say, consider this time as a time for you to create time for stillness, to create spaciousness, to heal, to weed out anything you don't need to do, and spend time just sitting in silence when you can. You know, supreme self-care is really important when you're going through heartbreak and loss too, of all kinds. And what I mean by that is you have to think of the ways in which you can care for yourself that will be gentle and nurturing. You might want to think of spending more time in nature, taking long Epsom salts baths. Spend time with good friends if you want to, or spend time on your own. Too, a lot of time on your own if that's what you wish to do. But most importantly, be gentle with yourself. Be gentle. Be self-compassionate. These are the things that are really going to help you as you go through loss. Oh, and one other thing, don't numb out. Don't numb out. Don't use any substance. Don't do anything to numb out, because your grief, your in loss is not going to go anywhere. It's going to land in your body until you feel it to heal it. So be gentle with yourself. Make spaciousness and do what you need to do. You know, I have this really close girlfriend and she had the news last year that she had breast cancer, that she got breast cancer. And I watched her immediately just do all the right things in my mind. You know, she immediately created spaciousness for herself. She pared back her schedule so that she would have time on her own to heal. She did what she needed to do for herself, even though sometimes it was in opposition of what the people around her wanted. For example, you know, people oftentimes, they want to show up for you when you're going through something. This is a woman that was has always been so caring of others, always the first person you would call if you needed something, and she'd be there. So people wanted to do that for her, but you know what she needed? She didn't want to be around people. She needed time on her own, and she knew that. So at the risk of disappointing others, she told people that she needed time on her own. She needed time just to be in her own healing cocoon. So right now, I thought we'd practice what surrender and trust looks like in the early stages of healing. So wherever you are, just sit comfortably, and you can lay on the floor, as I said earlier, and you can lay in, you know, a spread eagle position and just comfortably, your palms upright. And just close your eyes with me and breathe. And as you breathe and you breathe in through your nose, allow your chest and your belly to expand, taking in the fullness of your breath. And as you exhale, just allow yourself to sink into the floor, sink into your chair. As you breathe, you can sit comfortably and relaxed. And you can ask yourself, where do you feel tension in your body? If you're in loss or you're in heartbreak, this becomes a very important question. Because again, your body's going to tell you through your symptoms what you need to do in order to move that energy out. You might cough. You might feel your tummy hurts. Whatever your symptom is, it's telling you that you're not feeling your feelings deep enough. You're not expressing them out. So as you lay comfortable and you start to identify where is there tension in your body, just begin to breathe and just let yourself shake. Let yourself move. Let yourself wiggle your legs. Let yourself move your arms. Just breathe and let go and see if you can't shake a tear loose. See if you can't shake a sound loose. See if you can't just let go of what you're holding on to and let your tears come if they come. Let them empty out of you. Let them carve out a place in you for more joy to come, for more peace to come. Sometimes joy isn't present when we're going through loss, but peace can be. So as you go through this process and you make it a part of your own process of surrender and trust, you'll notice that it gets less and less scary and you feel more and more peace and you just feel better. The last thing I want you to notice is how are you feeling afterwards? My guess is if you're anything like I am or I was, you're going to feel a whole lot better after you go through this process. And you'll rinse and repeat several times, maybe even several times a day. Just do it as much as you need to empty out all of those emotions, those feelings that you have. Feel to heal. And remember that your breath, it's in the breath. This is the single most important practice that you can ever do, is just to be in your breath, feel your feelings, and know that in time it will dissipate just like dew does with the sunshine, and you're going to feel better.
Lecture 6, Embracing Change and Choosing Growth.
So this stuff of healing is really all about embracing the journey ahead. And what I want you to know is that when you're going through heartbreak and loss, you are standing on fertile ground, really fertile ground for your growth. But this really depends on what is your agreement with reality. Could you see this as a time of richness in your life, a time where your soul is calling you to grow? This loss is actually possibly something that has shown up to transform you, to change your life for the better. But you have to be really open to that. This understanding of your agreement with reality is your pivot into growth and healing. So transformation means that life is not perfect, but everyone can transform. Everyone heals. Yet it can be messy. Childbirth is really messy too, but on the other side is an incredible gift. And on the other side of transformation, there's an incredible gift waiting for you too. I'm going to share with you a story of the very first woman that I ever helped through her grief. Really, I call it more like being a doula. Really is, because we just can, if we reach out and we help somebody else, it's probably the easiest way to help ourselves is to help somebody else. And that's certainly what I found. I had just finished the book, Heartbroken Open, A Memoir Through Loss to Self-Discovery. And some friends of mine told me about a woman who had just lost her husband, a friend of theirs. And they asked me, would I meet with her? So I met Mary at a restaurant. And I remember just looking at her just 2 weeks after her husband died and how just completely heartbroken she was, how completely shattered she was. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this is like looking in a mirror of me 2 years earlier. I knew how she felt. I put my hand across the table and I looked in her eyes and I said, Mary, look into my eyes. I want you to see hope. I want you to see that you are going to heal. And I'm going to tell you now, you've got to trust someone and I hope that you trust me. So we all need the support of the right people. We all need to be held in our loss, in our grief. And we want to be with people who can hold us without fixing us, who see our brokenness as completely temporary. Believe me, in my own loss, I realized that our earthly angels show up. They really do, and they showed up for me. Now I'm going to touch on how mindfulness can be extremely helpful as you decide you want to help others in loss. And this is how you can be mindful as you help others. You can think in terms of holding space with what I like to call empty presence. And what that means is that you listen with an emptiness inside where you're holding the person. You know that you don't need to fix them. There's nothing to fix. You need to provide a container for them, a safe place for them to land so that they can talk with you, cry with you, be with you. The next thing I'm going to say can sting a little bit. I'm going to say that we can't possibly necessarily know what somebody's feeling when they're feeling it, and we don't know where they are in their grief. And so I'm going to say that fewer words and more love are the best strategy in this situation. I remember when I was in loss, the last thing I wanted to hear was some trite phrase from somebody, even though people mean well and they want to say something. But I'm just going to say it again, fewer words and more love. The times when people would come up to me and say, I know I don't know what you're feeling, but I want you to know I'm praying for you and you have my love, that really made me feel like they had my back and know they didn't know what I was feeling. And I just want you to be aware that you might not know what somebody's feeling either. So fewer words and more love. And remember, you don't need to fix them. It's really important to allow people to do their grief, to allow themselves to cry when they need to cry, to be angry when they need to be angry, to feel all of the emotions that come in heartbreak and loss. I love this Japanese art of tradition, which is called kintsugi. The reason I love it is that kintsugi takes a broken piece of pottery, and the kintsugi artist looks at that object in its brokenness, and they put gold, they repair that object with gold. And the beauty of this is that the kintsugi artist doesn't see the object as broken. The kintsugi artist sees that its character is enlivened, its character is enhanced by filling these imperfections with gold. So instead of seeing them as imperfections, they're actually highlighted as part of their character. And we, in the same way, can grow and heal and experience that same alchemy of change. That can happen for us too. And our character can grow, and we can become more beautiful in our loss too. So let's go ahead and take another golden pause. The reason why is I think it's so valuable for you to learn how to do this so that you can practice this day to day in your daily life, no matter what you're going through. So let's go ahead and try again and do another one. So wherever you are, sit comfortably. And if you're seated on the floor in your Indian style, place your palms open on your lap. If you're seated in a chair, please uncross your legs and sit upright and close your eyes and begin to breathe with me. As you breathe in through your nose, allow your chest and your belly to fully expand, taking in the maximum of your breath, the fullness of your breath. And as you exhale, just go ahead and let go. Even let out a sigh. Feel the tension leave your body. This time as you breathe in golden sunlight, pure golden sunlight to the tips of your fingers and toes, to your core, to your head, pure golden sunlight. And as you exhale, just sink in a little bit deeper. Relax a little bit more. And this time as you breathe in golden sunlight, breathing it into every cell of your being, place your hand on your heart, activating your heart, opening your heart. Just spend a moment thinking of one thing that you feel incredibly grateful for. Could be something as simple as this breath right here, right now. And as you continue to breathe, breathing in that gratitude, filling your heart with gratitude, go ahead and exhale and open your eyes. So I'm going to talk about what it really means to embrace change and how you can choose growth, and that how you choose growth is really choosing transformation, choosing a transformation that is going to transform you into something better, not bitter. But it does require you making a choice. And this means right now we're going to talk about how you can choose your agreement with reality. Now, this is the largest pivot that you'll make, is your understanding of this. And that is that life is happening for you. Even this loss, even this change, even this thing that has shattered your life is happening for you. And I just want you to know that you might lever back and forth between all sorts of feelings, whether you might feel angry, you might feel sad, you might feel self-pity. I know I did, and you might lever back and forth between feeling victimized by what's happened. And believe me, everyone asks the question when they're going through huge change and adversity and loss, why did this happen to me? But here's where you know you've really shifted. Here's where you know you can shift and change your agreement with reality. When you can shift from saying, why did this happen to me, to why did this happen for me? That's when you know your agreement with reality has shifted from being a victim of your circumstances to being the hero of your own story. Now, there is a profound gift that you're going to receive in this shift. If you can shift to, why has this happened for me? And that is going to be your message in the mess. The circumstances of your life really don't make or break you, but they do reveal who you are. And we don't always get to choose the hand we're dealt in life, but how we play the hand and how we think, those are our choices, and that's how we move forward. We get to choose how to move forward. All right, so I just want to share with you for a moment that my message in the mess happened when I was sitting on stage with Oprah. Just 11 months after Richard's death, I went to Oprah. She asked me to come, and we paid tribute to him. And she asks me on camera, "Chris, do you think that Richard's death has given you the gift of feeling your life?" And in front of about 20 million viewers, I had a golf ball the size, you know, a tear the size of a golf ball in my throat. And I gulped and I let those tears fall. And I said, absolutely. And I was crystal clear that she was right about that. That whole passionless time that I was feeling before Richard passed, before he died, I was really clear that I was one passion-filled woman now. And I was really clear that this was going to be part of what my message in the mess was. And boy, I'll tell you, I was like this. I was like, gee, if I gotta wake up this way, everyone has to wake up. Everyone that I meet anyways. So when you've begun to accept what is, and you can ask and answer, what's your message in the mess? You have made the pivot toward true growth and true transformation, and you are really on your way to embracing this change. Now, our relationship to our experience and our thoughts is really what matters most. And when your thoughts converge with your agreement with reality, you create a story. So what's your story? It's the stories that we tell ourselves in the quietness of our own thoughts that matter most. Now, you can tell this is true by, you know, look at people in families. They have the same mom, the same dad. One person in that family will tell the story that their mom was hard on them. She was a taskmaster. The other person in the same family will say, no, my mom was gentle and kind. Right? Because again, it goes back to that separate reality that we're viewing the world through our own lens. But it's the story that we tell ourselves about what happens to us that matters most. It really is. Because life is always happening, and we can create any story that we want. In my work, I don't just tell people to go inward, that this is an inward journey. I actually show you how. And in my latest book, From Heartbreak to Wholeness, The Hero's Journey to Joy, I use what I call the soul mantra and soul inquiry and journaling, a transformational writing process, to show you how to go inward, because it is in the questions that you ask that you will receive the answers. Now, the soul mantra becomes a guidepost, something to put your attention on, but it also has an intention. And the mantra that I spoke of earlier, surrender, trust, accept, release, and receive, we're going to start to break that down a little here. So surrender, trust, and accept. I feel to heal. Let's try it. Let's do a soul mantra. So this isn't a lot different than what we've been doing, but we're going to repeat the mantra about 10 times silently to ourselves, and I'll just chime in now and then so you don't get bored. So let's go ahead and try it. Go ahead and close your eyes and sit comfortably. And just begin to breathe with me. Take a few deep breaths in through your chest. Allow your belly to expand and exhale and sink in and relax. And as you breathe, just repeat to yourself, I surrender, trust, and accept. I feel to heal. I surrender, trust, accept, I feel to heal. I surrender, trust, accept, I feel to heal. I surrender, trust, and accept, I feel to heal. As you repeat this mantra silently to yourself, you can sit and practice this at another time and practice for at least 10 minutes. Allow yourself to really sink into those words and just gently return to those words if your thoughts wander. But for now, let's go ahead and open our eyes and continue. So the soul inquiry follows the soul mantra. You do a meditation to sort of put yourself in that grounded, aware state and open to your own inquiry. And then you ask the questions and then you journal the answers, uncensored. That's the important part. Just allow yourself to journal. Just the other day, my friend was sharing with me that she was doing this process and she was just amazed at what was coming out. Things that she never even considered. She was dealing with something and she never even considered these things that were just coming out of her, coming from her pen. And that's how healing journaling can be. Your soul inquiry could be, what's your message in the mess? As we talked about earlier. So what I'd love for you to see right now is that you do have choices amidst adversity, that sometimes we stand at the fork in the road of our choices, and your pivot toward healing could be a very important choice that you make. I know that I saw my choices early on in my grief. About 48 hours after Richard died, I was sitting at our fireplace, and I remember seeing very clearly that I could go down two paths. One might be that I wouldn't pull the covers up over my head. Even though I had girls in high school, I still could see that that was a choice, that I would just stay in bed and I wouldn't survive this loss. I wouldn't go on with my life. And the other was that I could see myself honoring Richard, doing right by my children, and standing in what was given to me, that I knew that I didn't have a choice. I knew I couldn't change this, but I knew that I could step in and I could move forward. Here's the great teaching here, and that is that we don't live at the affect of our circumstances when we choose not to be the victim. This is the pivot toward acceptance and rebirth. All of what happens is there for our growth. All of what happens is happening for us. And it's the stories we tell ourselves that matter most. Now I'm going to talk about moving forward and leaning in, embracing the unknown with gentleness and self-compassion is key. This is the result that happens, and this is what you'll find after you practice surrender, trust, and accept as a mantra for living and healing. But first, we have to address your fears. Some people don't have much fear in change, but I would say most of us have plenty of fear in change. It's normal to feel fear during big life change. Few of us automatically embrace immediately something that presents us with this identity crisis. So most of us, again, we need to address our fears. So let's talk about how to embrace fear and lean in. Moving through your fear, you can think of it like I do, and that is there's a hoop of fire, and this hoop of fire is in front of you, and on the other side of that hoop of fire is actually there's a gift. There's something beyond that hoop of fire, but this hoop of fire is pretty big, and it's screaming warning, warning. Now, I'm going to tell you that your hoop of fire is created by your ego. Why? Because you're going through a loss of identity and your ego screams in loss of identity. Your ego wants to put that fear in front of you because it's saying it's not a safe place to be.